This is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca reporting. President-elect Trump in a phone call with the president of Taiwan. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said today he hopes Beijing's relationship with Washington will not be damaged by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's telephone conversation with Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen. Trump tweeted late Friday that Taiwan's president had actually called him rather than the other way around, as some media had reported. No U.S. president or president-elect has spoken with a Taiwanese leader since the United States broke diplomatic ties with Taiwan in 1979 in favor of a relationship with China. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says U.S. President-elect Donald Trump wished him success with his crackdown on drug dealers, a campaign that has left more than 4,000 dead since July. Duterte said the future U.S. leader told him he was conducting his strike on drug dealers as a sovereign nation the right way. Duterte won the presidential election earlier this year, largely based on his promise to continue aggressively targeting drug dealers, users, and criminals. U.S. General John Nicholson, the commander of the International Forces in Afghanistan, has briefed reporters on the situation in the so-called AFPAC region, encompassing Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Our shared goal with our Afghan partners is the defeat of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State Khorasan inside Afghanistan. Now, there are 98 U.S.-designated terrorist groups globally. 20 of them are in the AFPAC region. This represents the highest concentration of terrorist groups anywhere in the world.
Nicholson also said he spoke very frankly with Afghan military and government leaders about certain problems they face in their ongoing problem with the Taliban, but said Afghan forces are prevailing. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States and Russia are exploring new ways to break a month-long diplomatic deadlock over how to stop the fighting in the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo. Speaking at a joint news conference with his Italian counterpart in Rome, Mr. Kerry urged continued efforts in dealing with the humanitarian situation in Aleppo, saying it's important that all parties work on a framework to provide a passage for people to get out of the besieged city.
Hopefully, if the humanitarian situation could be dealt with in Aleppo more effectively, and if indeed we could create a framework for the passage of people out of Aleppo so that Aleppo itself might be able to be relieved from this agony, that could open up the space to perhaps be able to start some kind of conversation in Geneva. That is Stefan de Mistura's goal. That's our goal. It is the apparent Russian goal. We don't know if it's Assad's goal at all. But that is what has to be put to test over the course of the next few days.
Now, Friday's diplomatic discussions took place at the Mediterranean Dialogue Summit. It was hosted by Italy. Special envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, spoke today from the stage, offering what he feels is the essential element in the solution.
So bottom line, regardless of whether there is a military victory or a non-military victory in Syria, you still need a push for a political, inclusive, real solution, including the region. This is a proxy war. It needs to be a proxy peace, too.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, political talks mediated by the Catholic Church have suffered a major setback with the withdrawal of the president's supporters. William Clowes has more from Kinshasa for VOA.
For more than a month, the National Episcopal Conference of Congo, the influential body which represents the Catholic Church, has been working to avoid a crisis in the DRC. The institution, known as CENCO, has been mediating between the presidential majority, President Joseph Kabila's political alliance, and the Rassemblement, a large coalition of opposition groups. CENCO is hoping to facilitate an agreement between the parties that will reduce the chances of unrest on December 19th. Several hours earlier, Abbe Donatien Chollet, CENCO's deputy secretary general, had conceded that all was not well. Chollet told reporters that disagreements remained over important questions, including the interpretation of the Congolese constitution. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Elections had not been organized in 2016 as they were supposed to have been, and the presidential majority argues that the constitution allows Kabila to stay in office beyond the end of a second term until the polls are held. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Klote is away on assignment.
Now they still under the police investigation. If the proofs really that they are 20 people who organized this ambush.
Five people arrested in Burundi for allegedly attempting to assassinate a presidential aide.
When we vote finish at the close of the polls, we empty all the ballot papers in the open on tables, with all agents and observers around, and we audibly count the ballot after sorting.
Ghanaians got polls next week, but how prepared is the government for the vote?
South Africa, unfortunately, has a great culture of drinking and driving. They seem to think it is their right. There is a big culture of being proud of being so drunk and not remembering where you parked your car.
And we take a look at South Africa's high rate of alcohol-related road deaths. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Gambians across Africa and elsewhere are rejoicing at the news that longtime dictator and autocratic ruler Yahya Jammeh has conceded defeat in Friday's presidential elections. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on the significance of the end of an era that started with a coup d'etat 22 years ago.
Celebrations erupted in the streets of the Gambian capital, Banjul, at the news that longtime ruler Yahya Jammeh, who has vowed never to leave power, has lost the presidential elections. 19-year-old unemployed Suleiman Sawane is ecstatic.
Gambia, we are suffering for 22 years. This guy
we need peace.
For
we need peace. We need peace.
Ami Toure, a 22-year-old student, says she finally felt some freedom.
We're so happy today. Today is the day we stand on our feet and we give free speech. We can say anything we want to say without any soldier or any police harassing us or anything.
But for Buba Fati, a 32-year-old medical worker, this was a dream come true.
I think I'm one of the most happiest guys today throughout the whole world, because this is what I've been looking for so many years. And right now, today, my dreams have come true.
The Independent Electoral Commission announced Friday that winner Adama Barrow won 45% of the total votes, while Jammeh took about 36%. A third candidate, Mama Kande, won 17%. Christopher Fomunyo of the National Democratic Institute spoke to VOA by phone from Accra in Ghana, where he's getting ready to observe presidential elections there taking place in a few days.
In the past 2 decades, we've seen many violations of human rights, many lawyers, journalists, and human rights activists imprisoned. So it comes as a relief that someone who had initially said that he would never relinquish power has accepted the verdict of the polls.
Jammeh, 51, has ruled the small West African nation since taking power from Dauda Kairaba Jawara in a military coup in 1994. Fomunyo says this is very significant.
In the early 90s, Gambia was one of only 4 African countries, the other 3 being Senegal, Botswana, and Mauritius. These were the only 4 countries that even accepted political pluralism. And so it came as a shock when Yahya Jammeh staged the coup in 1994 and took over the reins of government. Very quickly, he moved from being a benign soldier to a very autocratic leader.
Jammeh's challenger, Barrow, is the candidate for a coalition of 7 opposition parties. Usain Umbeng, the chairman of the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists based in the U.S., says he and his friends couldn't be happier that the Jammeh regime is over.
a brutal regime, a tyrannical regime, and a very, very selfish. Jammeh has really pushed Gambian progress another, 50 years.
Mbenga says this is a new era in the history of the Gambia. He adds that people should start working on building strong institutions to prevent someone like Yahya Jammeh from ever ruling his beautiful country again. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Burundi police say they have arrested five suspects linked to the attempted assassination of President Pierre Nkurunziza's aide, Willy Nyamitwe. The government has already accused neighboring Rwanda of being behind the targeted assassinations in the country. Moses Habyarimana has the story from Bujumbura.
Last Wednesday, President Pierre Nkurunziza's aide, Willy Nyamitwe, survived an assassination attempt by an armed group near his home in the outskirts of Bujumbura. One of Nyamitwe's bodyguards was shot dead during the ambush. Burundi police spokesman Pierre Nkurikiye says five suspects with military rankings have been arrested so far.
The two colonels and the captain have been arrested yesterday, but the first corporal and the lieutenant colonel had been arrested before the ambush, and the corporal avoided that. They wanted to kill. There is a police investigation team, and the team did his job.
According to Burundi security officials, this is not the first time Mr. Nyamitwe has been targeted. The police spokesman says the recent attack is the third attempt on Nkurunziza's aide.
But now they still under the police investigation. If the proofs really that they are between people who organized this ambush, they will be brought to justice. And if they see they are innocent, they could be released. They are now in the prison of the National Intelligence Service here in Bujumbura.
Relations between Rwanda and Burundi have continued to deteriorate since last year, after Rwanda accused Burundi of sheltering the Democratic Force for Liberation of Rwanda, or FDLR rebels. The rebels are accused by Kigali of committing the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. In return, Burundi and the international community accused Kigali of militarily training Burundian refugees who could later attack their own country. Burundian authorities say that the recent attempted assassinations of Pierre Nkurunziza's aide is among the series of attacks that Rwanda have tried to mobilize. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Ghana chooses its president next Wednesday, December 7th. Among a handful of candidates, that the standouts are President John Dramani Mahama and Nana Akufo-Addo. Akufo-Addo is a former attorney general and foreign minister who has twice tried to unseat Mr. Mahama. In addition, voters will choose 275 members of parliament. VOA's Peter Kilote is reporting on the election from Accra. He sat down with Eric Kofi Zakapasu, spokesman for the Ghana Electoral Commission, to find out how the government has prepared for this crucial national vote.
They could as well take permission from their superiors, from their offices, and then think the government in its wisdom, the Minister of Interior, decided you can just take some leave off your office, go and vote, and then come back to work.
So what is the issue of campaigning? Campaigning so far with all these political parties, six, particularly with the presidential, a single independent presidential candidate, how is the campaigning going so far? Are you monitoring it?
We've been following it closely, and I think by and large, despite the rhetorics, I think they are comporting themselves, except for the fringe element. Political campaigning and public gathering are regulated by the Public Order Act, and the beauty of the system is that it's like all of them are complying. So hardly do you get the two major parties converging at the same place to campaign. Mm-hmm. It's always this one moves here, and this, by the time they leave, the other one also follows. Hardly have we had a situation of serious conflict or violence erupting, okay, except for two major ones the one which occurred in the premises of the flag bearer of the presidential of the NPP, in a very tight election, as close as hours, and when the issue has become so emotive, you can rule them out.
Some Ghanaians are saying that this election is going to be particularly competitive. Do you share that view?
Where I stand and where I look at things, I've always taken all elections to be competitive.
Right.
We have never, under any circumstance, underrated any elections. And our elections have always been closely fought from 1992.
Let's talk about the results. Issues have been raised about the modalities by which the Electoral Commission will transmit the results. What are the modalities, and are the parties satisfied with the explanations given by the EC, particularly with the electoral result transmission?
Yeah, results transmission. Let's put it in this context. You see, we have a system of transmitting results which is captured in law.
Right.
The law tells us how to go about it.
Right.
Then, as part of the electoral reforms, it was decided to open up the process more, make it more transparent and more inclusive, so that even people outside the immediate circle of the resource transmission, counting, declaration process can also have access and view what exactly is going on. So back to the traditional mechanisms of resource transmission. We vote in the public.
Right.
Now, when we vote finish at the close of the polls, we empty all the ballot papers in the open, on tables, with all agents and observers around, and we audibly count the ballot. After sorting, we count audibly for each candidate, after which we all agree on the total ballot going to each person, the rejected ballot, everything is done. Then the results are put on the statement of poll and declaration of results sheet. Okay, now when this is done, from the polling station level, the hard copies, the ballot box is sealed, of course, and all parties affix their seals to it. Then the hard copy of the result sheet are taken to the collation centers. So at the collation centers in a constituency, all the polling station results of the parliamentary election are brought together. Then the winner is what? Declared at that level. Copies of the results are faxed or scanned or emailed to the regions, and the regions also fax or email them to the national. Okay. And because the presidential, the country is one constituency, results are not declared at the constituency level.
Right.
The total of the presidential at the constituency level is announced, the summary together with the collation sheet scanned and emailed to the region, then to the national. This is the traditional. Then we sit down and then manually adapt the figures before the returning officer, who is the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, declares the presidential results. Okay. Now, in addition to this, is where we have brought in the electronics transmission. Okay. To the extent that we use the fax and the email, there's some element of electronics transmission. But in addition to this, we brought in the electronics transmission, where you are aware we brought in some vendors who could not meet the specification and we had to terminate the contract. But the good news is that in-house, the commission itself has developed an electronic means of transmission, which we have experimented or piloted in our previous by-elections.
That was Ghana's Election Commission spokesman, Eric Kofi Zakpasu, talking with my colleague, reporter Peter Klote, about the national election next Wednesday. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, says more than 40 people need food assistance across the Southern Africa before the harvest next March. Zimbabwe and Madagascar, two of the worst hit countries, the UN agency has been able to secure only 22% of the funding needed to ease the region's worst drought in 35 years. Sebastian Mhofa has more from Harare for VOA.
Chimimba David Piri, the head of FAO in Southern Africa, told journalists in Harare Friday that of the $35.8 million the UN agency in the region need to fund the effects of El Nino, only $8 million has been secured. The region was hit by El Nino-induced drought, but forecasts point to a better season ahead, which might result in more than average rainfalls. In an interview with VOA, Piri summed up the current situation.
The food security situation in Southern Africa is bad. Estimated 40 million people that are expected to be in need of food assistance in the coming January to March in Southern Africa as a whole. All countries were affected by El Nino drought. Some hotspots are worse than others. Southern Madagascar is in dire need of immediate support. There, if we do not provide support very quickly and urgently, we might find that a famine might develop.
Piri said other Southern African countries were feeling the effects of El Nino less because their governments and international agencies like USAID and the European Union had moved in to ease the situation. El Nino-induced drought has not only left people in Southern African countries without food, but also affected some parts of the Horn of Africa, including Ethiopia, which earlier this year asked for international assistance to feed about 10 million of its citizens. In Southern Africa, the other most affected countries are Malawi and Zimbabwe. The latter, once the breadbasket of Africa, is about 5 million people in both urban and rural areas in need of assistance until the harvest expected next March. At one point, President Robert Mugabe's government asked for assistance for more than a quarter of the country's 13 million people. UN Resident Coordinator in Zimbabwe, Bishop Parajuli, says between now and the next harvest is a critical period.
Therefore, we really need to work hard to meet the critical need of the people during that period. Zimbabwe is in a mix of economic crisis, and it has a tough situation because of the drought, and the Zimbabwean people really need help at this critical juncture.
The UN diplomat was referring to areas of the social sector such as health, water and sanitation. He said of the more than $350 million being sought for those areas, about $200 million had been committed, and he called for more donors. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The World Health Organization says South Africa has the highest rate of alcohol-related road deaths in the world. According to its 2015 Global Report on Road Safety, almost 60% of all fatalities happen because motorists are driving under the influence of liquor. The government says about 14,000 people are killed in road crashes every year. But independent analysts say the annual death toll is over 20,000, and they accuse the state of not doing enough to prevent drinking and driving. Darren Taylor reports in this part of a series examining South Africa's road safety crisis.
A scene repeated in bars across South Africa every day. A patron walks in, tosses his car keys on the counter, and starts drinking alcohol. Here, driving after consuming just two beers is illegal. But, says Caro Smith of the non-profit South Africans Against Drunk Driving, this isn't deterring the nation's dedicated drink drivers.
South Africa, unfortunately, has a great culture of drinking and driving. They seem to think it is their right. There is a big culture of being proud of being so drunk and not remembering where you parked your car or how you got home.
10 years ago, Smith was an alcohol and drug educator in schools. A big part of her job was to warn young people against driving under the influence of liquor.
And then unfortunately, my own child, Chaz, was killed by a drink driver in 2005.
Smith now campaigns for better enforcement of the country's laws against drinking and driving.
We've got to get the person caught quickly. We've got to get justice to accept that it is a crime and implement the laws that are there. We've got very good laws. We're just not implementing them.
The World Health Organization says laws to prevent drink driving are poorly enforced in South Africa. Howard Dembowski is chairman of the Justice Project, an NGO that monitors South Africa's traffic sector and road laws.
We have the National Department of Transport telling the World Health Organization that 58% of road fatalities in South Africa involve alcohol. and yet we don't have proper alcohol enforcement.
South Africa's Department of Transport did not respond to VOA's numerous requests for a reaction. But senior traffic police official Edna Mamonyane says officers launch regular operations to arrest people for drinking and driving. Smith says this isn't enough to prevent it.
There is a lot of lip service saying we want to stop it, and yet they're not using the internationally best practice methods of stopping it, like testing 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, and not just at Christmas or Easter time.
According to Justice Project research, only 6% of the thousands of people arrested annually for allegedly driving under the influence of alcohol are ever convicted. Dembowski says this is because of factors like botched investigations and police corruption. This woman, whose voice has been disguised to protect her identity, says she paid a cop to squash the drink driving charge against her son.
Everybody knows it costs you 10, 15 grand and you can get it to disappear.
In the rare cases that drunk drivers are convicted, says Smith, the results are mostly disappointing.
When people have drunk and killed or severely injured, they're giving them absolute slap on the wrist. They're not giving jail sentences.
South Africa's Transport Minister, Dipuo Peters, wants all suspected drunk drivers to be imprisoned until their court hearings are complete. But Dembowski says it's wrong to punish people before they've been convicted of a crime.
That is just not acceptable in any modern criminal justice system. You cannot presume people to be guilty until they prove themselves innocent. Our constitution says the exact opposite.
Dembowski says if Peters gets her way, tens of thousands of people will be languishing in South Africa's already overcrowded jails for a long time. In South Africa, it's law that blood from alleged drunk drivers must be tested to establish the alcohol level. Dembowski points out that the country's national testing laboratories have a huge backlog of blood samples related to drink driving cases.
Are you going to detain those people in jails until they are acquitted, which could take up to 10 years?
Because the test results are only available years after the alleged crimes, magistrates mostly abandon the cases against suspects, allowing serial drunk drivers back on the roads. Smith believes there'll be much less drink driving in South Africa if it becomes stigmatized, like in Australia, for example. 20 years ago, she says, many Australians didn't think driving under the influence was a crime. Then the Australian government ordered the police to test people at all hours of the day and night, and to take strong action against drunk drivers.
What people then started to do was say to their friends, please don't drink and drive tonight. You're going to get a criminal record, or you're going to be put in jail, or you'll get a big fine. And so behavior changed because of the repercussions of the law actually tightening up.
Since 1997, the Australian authorities have tested tens of millions of motorists for driving under the influence, and arrests for the offense are now relatively rare. Smith urges South Africa to do the same. But, says Dembowski, if that was to work here, the government would have to introduce radical reforms, including ending traffic police corruption and transforming its testing, justice and prison systems. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Next on Let's Talk, the act and art of modeling. How popular is it in Africa? Would you choose modeling as a career? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing modeling. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Up next, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Yes, and now it's time for a Saturday Music Spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
Yes. She just spent my money, oh. What am I gonna tell my mommy, oh? I shouldn't listen before.
Baby, so sweet. your future great. Brother, no story, no story. Make you no regret. Hey, yeah. If not to celebrate, you go plan on when. If not your planning day, now so you go run away. So go make you gum body with your baby boo. Sit down and discuss somewhere low, like you're supposed to do. Cause the people we happy, now them wanna plan well.
Fire, fire. must become my lady. Oh yeah, you drive me crazy. Yeah, I can't explain this feeling.
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope to see you again tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the holding of elections on November 20th as an important step towards returning Haiti to full constitutional rule and addressing the serious challenges the country faces. This election enabled the Haitian people the opportunity to vote for a president as well as parliamentary representatives. A mere 7 weeks following widespread destruction to Haiti's southwest peninsula caused by Hurricane Matthew, Haiti's government and electoral authorities were resolute in ensuring that all citizens had the opportunity to vote for their future. U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said, "We commend Haitians for exercising their right to vote in a peaceful manner and in some areas amidst difficult circumstances. The United States welcomes the continued determination of the Provisional Electoral Council, the Haitian National Police, and the government of Haiti towards the realization of free, fair, credible, and peaceful elections." Successful elections are essential to the prosperity, governance, and future of Haiti, said U.S. Special Coordinator for Haiti and Deputy Assistant Secretary Kenneth Merton. In order to address key issues facing Haiti, such as recovery from Hurricane Matthew, electoral and judicial reform, anti-corruption measures, and the need to spur economic growth, Haiti must have political stability and a legitimate government with a 5-year mandate. The United States takes note of the Provisional Electoral Council's November 28th announcement of the preliminary presidential results. As we await for final results, we urge everyone in Haiti to foster an atmosphere of calm during the appeals process to ensure that Haiti remains on track toward democratic renewal of its state institutions and the seating of a president elected by the Haitian people. The legitimacy of Haiti's rightful place among democracies in the hemisphere depends on its return to constitutional authority consistent with the principles enshrined in the Inter-American Democratic Charter.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.